ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, we have a really interesting guest for you, Todd Eckert, founder of Tindrum, a mixed reality content production studio. In his former position as director of content development at Magic Leap, Todd worked to actively and positively change the relationship between artist and audience. He initiated the company's volumetric capture system and much of the initial creative ideology. Todd started his career as a music journalist at age 14, covering such bands as the Cocteau Twins and The Cure. He then worked in art and media for the next 10 years. He was the producer of Control, the Anton Corbijn-directed biopic about Joy Division frontman Ian Curtis, which won awards at Cannes Film Festival, Edinburgh, and the BAFTAs. Hi, Todd. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to talk broadly about VR and AR and then dive into the specifics of your new creative shop, Tindrum, if that's okay with you.
Certainly.
Fantastic. Okay, so virtual reality has generated a lot of buzz in the tech world over the last couple of years, and many analysts speculated that 2016 was going to be the year the VR went mainstream, and it didn't. And then analysts are saying, oh, 2017 is going to be the year it goes mainstream. And others say it will take a decade or more. And Google search are the headlines and you can find sort of anything. What do you think? Who's right in this argument? When can we expect the average consumer is going to be using VR technology on a regular basis?
Well, I mean, I think when you have people whose job it is to get a certain amount of attention, so we are going to predict the ascent of a particular technology, or we are going to bemoan the demise of another technology, or bemoan the lack of its demise, whatever it is, I think there's the sense of, all right, you have the people who are creating the things, and you have a public who is maybe waiting for the things. You have a public that's really doesn't care what the conduit to experience is, so long as that conduit is fulfilling somehow. So
right.
I don't know that it's actually important to me or you or anyone what year virtual reality or mixed reality or hopefully somebody is going to come up with a better moniker, because I'm actually tired of the reality-based ones. But I don't know that any of that is actually meaningful. I think the entire point is, you know, what is a better way of telling stories? What is a better way of immersing ourselves in worlds? And I mean, I remember really, really well being at E3 years ago. I was actually working for a game developer at the time, and everybody was talking about PS3 and the new Xbox, and they were talking about their capabilities. And again, you had a lot of people, the kind of cottage industry of predicting the success of the future, and they're kind of commodities traders, really. And everybody was sitting around, they were talking about which one was going to be the winner. And that was the E3 that the Wii was revealed. And as you might imagine, it was on the day that it was revealed. There were all of these people that were cracking obvious adolescent jokes about the moniker. And what was amazing was it was sort of disregarded out of the gate, until by virtue of its kind of more compelling gameplay and then the fact that it was just more fun, it became quite clear, at least in the short term, that the people were more interested in that which was different, that was more human, that was more compelling. And whatever the predictors had guessed actually didn't mean anything.
Well, I guess then you're right. Bounding it by years isn't so particularly helpful. But what do you think that growth is dependent on? I mean, in terms of just to create that new storytelling experience, in order to become something that's folded into a broad swath of consumers, do you think it's driven by price point? Do you think it's driven by the underlying technology? Is it really all about the content? Is it about awareness? Is it about some constellation of the things? I mean, because it's sort of, it's a little woolly to say, oh, well, it's about, you know, new ways of storytelling. Because yes, that's true, but you know how.
Well, it is, but it's not. I mean, so go all the way back to something like the advent of film, where it was in this sort of nascent technology and super disruptive for its time.
Right.
And you say, okay, why does anybody care? If you have this entire world of vaudeville and you have all of these people that are running around from theater to theater and they are singers and they're dancers and they do these narrative pieces and it's storytelling and it's just, you know, it was the kind of normative genius of its day. And all of a sudden film comes in and nobody really cares about theater anymore. So why? What was it that made people depart from this kind of massive industry of the time? Mm-hmm. And it was because it was transportive, because it was fundamentally different. And people were able to dive into places that they never ever thought that they would see, even if those places were totally fake. So, you know, you've got the silent film card that says from the darkest jungles of Southeast Asia. And you look at it in retrospect, you go, I think that's Burbank. But
Ben, I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. But it doesn't matter because people were able to kind of dive into these worlds and feel something deeper and something that enlivened them. So what we've been looking at, it's not been the idea of, okay, what can we do to make any delivery mechanism successful. And in fact, that doesn't enter into our thoughts at all.
Okay.
We have people that are working on the first piece that we're putting out in France and England and Eastern Europe and Pittsburgh and New York and Los Angeles. And all of us are focused on, all right, what can we actually create that makes this digital event, for lack of a better term, makes it something that you want to live in. Don't just say what makes it better than a traditional film. Say what makes it better than a game or a book or absolutely any facet of life.
And so
the design of it actually starts with that. It's not, we're actually going against any of the sort of traditional mechanisms of media delivery and saying, we're going to start from a very basic point of view, which is these devices allow us to do certain things. Are any of those things interesting? And if so, why? And that's where we are.
Well, that's actually really interesting because it's really about attention. And I guess then to that point, the distinction between virtual or augmented is irrelevant. Would that be fair to say in your view that it doesn't really matter?
I think it's to every person. So I actually find, and forgive me, this may wind up sounding brash or like I'm slapping somebody around. I'm really, really not. But I was actually just looking at some numbers today, and 95% of Americans have cell phones. And 77%, at least as of January of this year, have smartphones. And so you have this kind of ubiquitous neck crane of people that are staring down at their hands looking for whatever it is that is more compelling than the world around them. And I understand that. It's just like stories on television are fantastic because they can be introduced, elevated, and resolved within 22 minutes. Wow, that's so good. Obviously they're crafted, and in fact I was talking to my son about the whole idea of stickiness and the fact that he doesn't want to get off the game that he might be playing, and you say, well, that's by design. And so VR is actually an extrapolation of this insular phone culture, where if you are in a virtual reality device, you're not even pretending to care about anybody outside the game or the event, whatever it is.
Right, right.
So you can't even have like a plausible excuse for the fact it's like, no, actually it's not about you. It's totally about me. And so I find that, since we're inherently social animals, I find that to be worrisome, just because the most amazing events that you'll ever experience are actually enhanced just massively by simple virtue of being able to look at somebody that you know or don't know, it doesn't really matter, and indicating either verbally or with your eyes, did you just see or hear or feel that? Because I did.
Right.
And without that process of affirmation, I think that we are lessened by the event, not elevated by it.
It's interesting. That's one of the things that I've often, one of the things that's interesting about the phone culture, which they've found, is television viewing, which used to be sort of, you would watch the television. Now, young millennials especially, it's multiple devices. They're watching the television, but they also have their phone and their tablet and their laptop, and they're all going at once. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I've often asked people involved with these technologies, especially the VR, is the need for occlusion, and will people be willing to stop participating with the people who they're participating with? Because I know it's hard enough to, there are no phones allowed at the table, there are no, we're having actual human connection time in my household. But you go out for a business dinner or a drink or something and people's phones are on the table. It's like, hello, I'm here. I'm actually the person at the table with you, you know? And then the messaging that's going on there. And so it's interesting that you sort of turned my thought on its head by pointing out that the VR is actually the ultimate extrapolation of that, that it is all about me. That's
fascinating. Well, I just had a thought, and again, forgive me, I haven't gone through this, but on the face of it, it seems right. This is a little bit like teenagers and booze or pot or whatever, where people are going to experiment with these things that on the face of it are pleasurable and interesting and elevating and whatever. And so they wind up having these experiences. They don't really know how they're going to affect them, but they don't care. I'm wasted and it's fun. Great. Good for you. So the reality of it is, as you gain maturity and an understanding of what these different influencers, whatever they are, would have on your life in an ongoing basis, then you learn how to either put it away completely or mediate its intake or whatever. Mm. So there's everybody at a business meeting having phones at the table, maybe an indication that business meetings are in general boring, but it also, yeah, but it, you know, it's like that perfunctory dinner where everybody actually wishes they were doing something else. But, the other side of it is, it's totally possible that we societally will just get our collective wits together and say, yeah, right, maybe we need to get rid of our phones, and or maybe the decision to remove them as a centerpiece of conversation will be our own as opposed to a societal one. One way or another, I think VR has the potential of doing certain things very well. I do think there's an inherent vulnerability to it that we develop with it at Tindrum, but that's simply because the devices that we are ultimately developing for are not really in the market. So we can develop on HoloLens, we can develop on Meta, but it's harder to actually drop sequences into Magic Leap or ODG or whatever.
Right.
So the ubiquitous and simplistic device is, you know, like a Vive or something.
Right. So now backing out back to Tindrum, can you tell us a bit about Tindrum, why you started it, and how it differentiates itself in an increasingly crowded marketplace for content, for VR content?
Well, so we're not doing anything for VR at all.
Okay.
And I was director of content development for Magic Leap, which is a device company, a head-mounted device company. And I was early with Magic Leap. I started working with the company at the end of 2012. And I left the end of last year because what I found is I think it's very difficult to focus on a device and to feel that inherent sense of competition with other devices. And at the same time, focus on creating those events that will define the way people respond to the device. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, Magic Leap, and by the way, I'm still very friendly with Magic Leap, and it's my intention that absolutely everything Tindrum makes will work on Magic Leap. It's, mm-hmm. it's actually really, really important to me. But the reality of it is, when you are a company that has raised a tremendous amount of money and you're looking out of the world and you're saying, all right, we're going to make the form factor, we're going to make the underlying technology, we are going to make the means to mass produce the underlying technology and the form factor, we are going to create the operating system, we are going to engage in partnerships, and we're also going to make some of the content, which is, you know, the reason that the device is proven to be important in the first place. What I found was that we weren't fulfilling that promise. It was like an exercise in collective narcolepsy where we would have a really great beginning of a conversation and then fall asleep, perhaps at the table. I don't know. And I decided that it was important to leave because there are a lot of reasons, but I think maybe the most important is the commoditization of technology is a massive part of how this world works. It's like the pundits that are predicting the ascent or demise of various devices.
Right.
It's very easy to talk about the financial success, the arithmetic bases of some device, some event, some show, a song, whatever it is. It is impossible to effectively quantitate the success artistically of any event. You know, Rotten Tomatoes will say that something critics think it's horrible and the public says something's great. So there is no universality of vision. And
It's interesting. I had a conversation just this morning with somebody. We were talking about the nature of truth. And
in a post-truth world.
His opinion, which is interesting, is he says truth is essentially that truth was fungible, that whatever the majority of people believed became de facto truth. So, you know, way back when, the majority of people believed that the earth was flat and the sun revolved around the earth. Therefore, that was the existing truth at the time. It was not the actual scientific truth, but for all intents and purposes, it didn't matter because the believed truth, the accepted truth, was this other thing. And it's interesting.
It's terribly difficult to again come to any form of consensus for what is fun, what is work, what is worthwhile. And ultimately, though, I think before the commodity of dimensional experience winds up ruling the capabilities of these devices,
right,
I felt like somebody had to jump in and say, all right, we have a certain amount of money. And we are going to create some of these events. Some of them will take place in public. Some of them will be for home consumption. Some of them you will have to go to a kind of traditional theater to see. But all of them will, we're not actually creating demos. I don't really believe in demo culture. We are creating complete things. So they have beginnings, middles, and ends, which means that the world may hate them or the world may find them compelling.
But they're full, complete experiences.
That's right. And that's really, really important to me because what I've found, particularly for mixed reality events, is that there are so few people that actually have been able to work in that field for any time at all, that there's a real lack of understanding as to what it can be.
Right.
And I've been fortunate in that I've been working there since 2012.
Right.
So so to say, all right, we're going to take the essence of storytelling and we're going to give you the transportability of film, but we're going to give you the intimacy of a theatrical experience, which means the relationship between audience and actor is semiotic as well as semantic. Or we're going to give you the ability to relate to an event in space, which means the space is equally important to the event itself. And we're going to create all of those things in a realm that is as social as people are.
Wow.
So maybe they're not social. Maybe they're scared of the world and they want to watch it alone in their homes. For most of them, they'll be able to. But let's say they want to invite somebody over because they found it compelling. They can do that too.
Wow.
It's not possible in VR, but it is in this.
Wow, that's amazing. That's sort of a nice segue. Also, one of the things that I had read, that one of the goals you had stated about your time at Magic Leap was to change the relationship between artists and audiences. And is that kind of what you're talking about, the relationship there, or were you thinking of something different?
No, that's absolutely what it is. I mean, if you take an artist that is on an average evening, let's say a musician that is on an average evening playing to an audience of between 10 and 20,000 people,
right,
then the relationship, it's one of motion and understood theatricality, but the human connection is largely gone. Now, it's totally possible that the audience doesn't really care about that human connection. But again, it's not even an option.
Well, would you argue, though, that human connection is just a different sort? It's you as part of the sort of amoeba of the audience that you have become this larger thing? I mean, you know, that.
So the way I would answer that is one of the reasons that I got totally obsessive about the idea of volumetric capture, which is capturing the entirety of a person as opposed to a flat image or a stereoscopic sort of like faked depth perception relationship,
right.
Was because I wanted people to be able to see David Bowie.
Right.
And Bowie was very, very important to me, was defining to me. And years before he died, he actually suffered a heart attack in, I think it was Switzerland, and stopped performing. And he was really compelling live. And you would think naturally, all right, it was part of the, I don't know, the show or this immense thing that was a Bowie gig. But after an album called Heathen, he had been playing this sort of traveling festival thing. And he wound up, he came back and he did all the boroughs in New York. And the first one was Staten Island. It was a theater that was actually undergoing renovation. But there were 300 people there that night. And it was like seeing Bowie in your living room.
Wow.
And you recognize, yeah, no, it was amazing, like to the point where St. Anne's Warehouse the next night was almost too big. But you recognized that Bowie was not about the event. Certainly those massive lights and those props and the theatricality that could be understood by soccer stadium, that was all there. But at its core, there was a very complex, totally compelling human being. And to see him to the point where you made eye contact and you understood him not as artifice, but as the very best of what people can be, was ultimately far more thrilling than the lights could ever be. And we have that capability within the technology that we have embraced. And it is my intention to bring that to everyone so that nobody ever has to miss Bowie again.
Oh, I can't wait to see your stuff.
It's going to be so cool.
So cool. So, I mean, I guess this is the other question, though. At the moment, you are really at the, you know, bleeding knife edge, out ahead, creating full-on content that's going to be not like, imagine if it was better. It's going to be the thing itself. No imagining required. Because you don't necessarily have all these other tech, you know, right now off the shelf, ready to go. Do you need to control the environment in other ways? Do you need to do it in a location, out of a museum, in a special controlled space? How much is that? And then how do we make it then, at least during this period of time, how do we make it accessible to people?
Is that a long running thing or what?
Well, it's funny because if you go all the way back to film, the whole idea of the Nickelodeon was a very similar problem that we have now. It's like, okay, so we've got these films, people are really into them. And what are we going to do? There's no distribution mechanism. There's no print mechanism. There's not even a cut in these films. They're just, you know, single reels that last however long they last. What are we going to do? And so the Nickelodeon was a crank and kind of this dark tube that people would look at the top of. They kind of bend over and they'd be able to see these things. And again, it was transportive and that was compelling. And if you look at, I haven't seen any in the United States. I've read about them going up in Europe, and I've visited this kind of VR. It was actually a component of a different amusement thing, but a specific VR kind of parlor in Tokyo at the end of last year. And so it's really kind of the same thing where you say, well, if this is compelling, then people are going to figure out ways to see them.
Right.
And so right now, everything that we're doing is meant to prove different facets of why this is a compelling medium, specifically the ability to drop things into the world. So it is music and it is narrative and it is, we're creating this one piece for a museum that is, again, its basis is in volumetric people, but it's relatable as if those people were performing the same movements ad nauseum. I think what you'll find is all of the device manufacturers, and surely there will be more before the end of this year, they're all basically asking the same question, which is, how do we get the public to adopt this is a compelling medium. And the companies are all saying, how did we get them to adopt ours? And just like in film, where the public adopted so many that they didn't actually care, where pretty much everybody that was in the early days of film did really, really well. And I actually, from my days at Magic Leap to an awareness of the other companies in the space, I know that everybody's really, really concerned with, you know, being at the kind of the top of that heap. But I honestly think they're all going to be successful. And so...
So you don't think it's like a VHS beta situation. You don't think that there will be a winner and there will be a loser, but rather that it will just... That as long as people are convinced that in some ways is the focus on the wrong thing, that actually more people should be focusing on what you're doing, which is proof of value through content versus whiz-bang... You have a device, but if nobody has anything useful to see on it, who cares?
Right. Well, I mean, I think the devices that I've tried, they all have different attributes. Some of them are weight. Some of them are fidelity. Some of them are tethered, so they can run more complicated pieces. Some of them are not, but you can walk around with them. I think there are different attributes that will make each one of them compelling in its own way. Again, I think there are so many uses for it. It's not that one device is going to supplant one other device. I think that you're going to find that dimension and depth adds something to pretty much every facet of life. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that that depth and dimension, that's going to become normative. We actually, the company was, you're going to find this hard to believe, somebody was able to trademark in North America, throughout North America and throughout Europe, the phrase, the world is not flat.
No.
And yeah, believe it or not. And so that's, to me, the most obvious explanation of where we're going versus where we've been. Because no matter who you are, no matter where in the world you live, you've seen something on a phone, on a television, on a computer, on a film screen. And it's a flat representation of the world. And I've produced film, and I've produced games. And these are brilliant mediums, but they are inherently lacking in the kind of weird, frazzled curves that make up being human.
Nice. What a nice tie back to truth and our conversation earlier about the truth and fact and the world is not flat. That's really how nice to come full circle that way.
I like when that happened. It's as if we planned it, but we didn't. Makes it
but
even
better. But we
didn't.
Exactly. Not at all.
No. We have run through a half hour. My goodness, it's actually even a little longer. I appreciate so much that you've taken the time to talk to us. It's been fascinating. One of the things I like to do, it's kind of a silly fun thing for me, just to finish it up. I say words and you give me your top of mind reaction. Can you play along?
I'll try really hard to
play along.
Keep it as something that won't offend people.
You could be the first person to offend people. No, my only rule is you can't think about it, because if there's too much silence, you're really thinking. Thinking aloud, just first reaction. Facebook. That's great.
Sorry. I mean,
No, it's very, that's good. Top of mind. Google.
Gestapo.
Snapchat.
Not sure.
Twitter.
Brief.
YouTube.
Old.
Ad blockers.
It's... Every response I'm thinking of is so smarmy.
All right. Asterisks. We'll just move on from that. Art.
Life.
VR. You like that idea?
No. Everything that popped into my mind there was terrible.
You should probably, the next one's AR, so.
Yeah. I mean, with all of those things, I'm kind of going into the Rorschach test of, you know, it's like, look, it's a panda or whatever.
And the last one's AI.
AI.
Yes.
Brilliant.
I would have put dollars to donuts that you would have said scary or Gestapo to that as well.
No, because that's like one of those things where, you know, juniper berries, So juniper berries, if you eat them off the vine, are incredibly toxic, sometimes fatal. And if you know how to treat them, you can kind of coerce them into some sort of alchemy. They can be ointments or gin or this incredibly fragrant thing. They're really, really complicated. And I think AI is a little bit like that.
I would end up killing myself with juniper berries. So I know my limits, I think, is probably.
Do you have a gin thing?
Oh, well, you know, there's that. Fine. Fair enough.
But I think AI is probably the closest that we'll get to an actual translation of God for most people. Because like God, it is both consistent and impossible to understand fully.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I kind of like that. That makes it more palatable to me. So that's good. Well, thank you so much for joining us for a conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Todd Eckert. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.